College. This is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and very excited to celebrate this beautiful weather, the spring season, the renewal of the earth doing what it knows to do, the joy of Mother Nature, what with Earth Week coming up and then Earth Day on the 22nd. So many wonderful things to be pleased about. So I'm going to ask you to put your cares away for the next 20 minutes to a half hour, at least, right? Maybe even longer. But very excited to welcome the representative, the newest and brightest representative of our wonderful, wonderful HFC Hammond Planetarium to our airwaves today. And we are very excited to meet this planetarium director and also person on our campus wearing multiple hats today. Planetarium director, but also full-time instructor here on campus for over a year now. And that is the one and only Professor Jesse Mason. Jesse, we're so excited to have you here today. And I'm looking forward to getting our listeners to get familiar enough with the Hammond Planetarium and all the beautiful things that it offers to get them to come in and sit down in the seats and relax a little bit and learn all the wonderful things you're teaching them about science and the stars and all that good stuff. So first and foremost, welcome to HFC, although you're not a newbie anymore, but welcome to our airwaves. Glad to have you here.
Thanks so much, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. As we talk about the HFC Planetarium, for years and years and years, that's what it was known as, the HFC Planetarium. And then I remember being at the dedication, actually, when it was dedicated in honor of the wonderful Mr. Hammond, who contributed financially and in so many other ways to support this endeavor. Can you give us a little backstory, a little bit about what makes a college planetarium perhaps unique from others that we might find at a science center or something, and also what your sort of philosophy is as you now have taken over the reins in running and directing our planetarium?
I think the simplest answer is accessibility. The planetarium here is extremely accessible to the college students here. They in many cases walk right around the planetarium to get to their classes. But it's also accessible to the members of the public. It's a completely free planetarium, and the whole goal is to try to reach as many people in the community as possible to bring the science of astronomy into their lives.
Well put. We talk about the concept of educating people on astronomy issues, and certainly we have the wonderful ability in the state of Michigan to experience the seasons, to experience a variety of very exciting celestial, you know, happenings. And we have the beauty for some of us that live in a darker area versus those that are polluted, if you will, with a lot of light, the ability to really step on our front porch, step out in our backyard, and experience the cosmos, right? Experience what's above us and around us and everything. But if we don't know what we're looking at, it's not as interesting, not as exciting. And it might still be that, moment, but we're not necessarily learning anything except that, you know, the galaxy is vast and we live in a beautiful, you know, beautiful place in this world. But why do you think, and why is it your passion to educate people on astronomy?
Well, certainly if you get in dark enough skies, just looking is good enough. It's just an amazing experience to be under the stars and the galaxy. But if you know a little bit about what you're looking at, it makes the experience, it heightens the experience, makes it a deeper experience. So the goal of, I think, any planetarium is to take that outdoor experience and put it indoors in a way where you can control things. For example, we control the movements of the stars in the planetarium, so we can show you what the movements of the stars look like over the course of a single night, to a single season, to an entire year. And learning those movements and learning constellations and stars, that I think gives you a not just a better understanding of the universe as a whole, but I think it gives you a better understanding of our place in the universe.
I said the word galaxy and I should have said the word universe, but we're all still learning, honestly. And I know some of these terms to the layperson are kind of interchangeable, but in fact, I'm sure they have very different and specific meanings. Don't even get me started on Pluto as a planet or a non-planet. That's a whole different debate. But what do you find in your education, putting on your professor hat when you're educating students on the science and I think the art, frankly, of astronomy? What are some of the aha moments that they have? What are some of the things that they're shocked to find out or pretty excited about as it comes to learning about this kind of whole new world that's out there?
I think the first thing people are shocked about is scale. The scales the distances and sizes we encounter and times we encounter in astronomy they're ungraspable to the human mind. So we have language to describe them, mathematics, we can describe the structure and evolution of things, but to actually grok those vast quantities, it's just beyond us. And when you start to scratch at the field of astronomy just a little bit, your mind is blown by how far things are apart, how big stars are, how big a galaxy is, how old our universe is. Those kind of things we just didn't evolve to handle. So when you get to them, you can spend a lot of cycles just pondering those things. Very often when I take students out or friends out to look at the stars and they want to tour the night sky, we start talking about those things with just the stars you can see with your eyes. And it's alarming to like look at a star that you're familiar with and be like, well, that light has been traveling since before I was born to get here.
And it really is mind-blowing. We know that on our campus, we have made a commitment to studying the stars, studying astronomy, and it's not just with the planetarium, the Hammond Planetarium, but our listeners might not know necessarily some of the other things that are going on. And we're going to talk in just a moment and invite our listening friends to actually participate in an upcoming planetarium show. But there are opportunities, even just doing a walking tour on this campus, to experience some of those things that you're talking about, like scales and models and so on. Can you fill us in a little bit on those types of options available?
Sure. On campus, we have a scale model of the solar system. We have right next to the planetarium, the scale model of the sun on a display, a computer display, and it's a touch display. It has lots of information about our sun, but we have one display distributed throughout campus for every planet in our solar system and the asteroid belt as well, I believe. And the experience of walking from display to display and then seeing the scale model size of the next planet, Mercury, and then the next planet, Venus, and you get to Earth and you keep going further and further from the sun and you get an idea of just how enormous our solar system is. And when we look out, we see Venus in the sky and, oh, it's right there. When you see the scale of it, you're like, whoa, it is really far away. And that's just peanuts compared to stellar distances, star distances between stars.
Yeah. Jesse Mason is joining us on the journal today, planetarium director and professor here at Henry Ford College, teaching all things related to astronomy and really educating anyone that wants to learn more about this just frankly awesome area of study. We have opportunities in Michigan, I think, to get to some dark sky places.
Yeah, dark sky parks.
Yeah, and we've got several up in northern Michigan, the big dark sky park. But also, this is, you know, we've got lots of rural areas where people can actually just, you know, either, you know, walk or drive or even just step out again and really have very little light pollution. So I think it's a pretty good state to live in for stargazing. Yes, would you agree?
I'd say it's in the middle somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say it's in the middle, but it has other things to offer. So I think it's like, it's prime real estate for stargazers. Because you don't have to drive very far to get to a great planetarium. You don't have to drive very far to see all the stars.
Yeah, good. When we talk about the changing seasons now, how does that impact what we're going to see and when? And does, for example, this like, did this winter impact what we might see this spring and summer? Does it work like that?
It's all about cycles. It's all about cycles. For the stars, the cycles are on the yearly. So the stars that we see, many of them change from season to season. And the same time next year, you'll see the same batch of stars. There are some stars that you can see all seasons. They're close enough to the North Celestial Pole, near our pole star Polaris, that they're up all year long.
That makes
and then you got the planets, which their positions change all the time. So what planets you can see in April of 2023 will not be the same set of planets that you can see in April 2024, which makes observational astronomy extremely exciting because there's always something new to be looking at. This, you will never look at the exact same sky twice.
It really is hard to wrap the brain around sometimes when you think of it in that scope and that, in that way. Jesse, in sort of the big picture of astronomy and stargazing, et cetera, we have this tendency, I think, as humans to not think so much about it until it makes the news, right? Or until there's some big, there's a big lunar eclipse, a big solar eclipse. You know, it won't happen again for 8 years or, you know, those kinds mm-hmm. of things. Or the latest comet that we may see, et cetera. So there really are wondrous things like that happening pretty much all the time. And is it just that the giant caliber ones are the ones that tend to make the news, which tend to excite people? And I remember, a nephew so excited about that last eclipse that he got so into stargazing and so on, got a telescope for Christmas, you know, that kind of thing. And I just love seeing that. But
was this the solar eclipse or the lunar eclipse?
It was the lunar eclipse. Yeah.
Okay. Most recently. Okay.
Yes. The most recent one.
Oh,
yeah.
Good for him.
And so the idea of, you know, having to wait for the magic to happen before we get excited about it seems a little prescriptive, but I guess that's good for the general population, right? To get these things covered and excited.
I think I, like other astronomers, are kind of torn when they hear this kind of stuff because some of it's just good press, but it's ultimately it's like whatever gets people excited about astronomy, I'm game for it. We'll talk about anything that has to do. You want to talk about UFOs? Go ahead. We'll talk about UFOs. Then we can talk about the vast distances they would have to cross to get here, and how would they possibly do such stuff like that? So, yeah, I will look for any hook that I can get in somebody to get them interested in astronomy, and then we can talk about all the astronomy. So, if you want to talk about the supermoon, I will refrain from eye rolling that it's only slightly bigger than normal. That's fine. You want to see the supermoon? Come on. Let's see if you can tell the difference. What's so special about a supermoon? Let's talk about the science of the lunar orbit. Why is it sometimes closer than other times? It's all good, in my opinion.
Yeah. Good. I love that attitude. And that was a trick question and you passed. So
oh, good.
Yay. So that's a good thing. We are, you know, for me, the concept of the planetarium, the Hammond Planetarium, can be something as simple as a lovely part of a date night, frankly, yep. or a really interesting opportunity for a grandparent to bring their grandchild to, one of those things, a group of friends are going to go out and get together. And why not, after you're done with your meal, swing by and just experience something really cool and really different. And I would argue that probably, you know, like, I'm thinking show of hands to our listeners, who has been to a planetarium in the past 10 years? I'm guessing I'm not seeing many hands up, and that's not the way it should be. And this opportunity right in our own backyard is just one that we want to continue to brag about. So let's talk specifically about our Hammond Planetarium, exactly how to participate in the activities. We've got the next one coming up right around the corner. And what are like the rules of being a part of a planetarium experience?
Like I said before, it's all about accessibility. We have no restrictions on age. Anybody can come. Now, granted, I suppose a three-year-old probably wouldn't have a great time at a planetarium, but we've seen 7-8-year-olds in planetariums. My eight-year-olds have come to planetariums and enjoyed the shows before. We get car clubs. We get seniors clubs. I think our next show, we're going to have Boy Scouts coming, perhaps. So we get a lot of different folks that are coming for different reasons. People that just, like you said, just want to have a nice night of entertainment, maybe a little bit of science in there just for funsies. That's great. Come on in. And then we get people that are like, you know, my son's 12. He just got a telescope. He's really into astronomy. Oh, perfect. Bring him. Anybody can come for any reason you want. If you want to come talk about UFOs, but, you know, we'll probably postpone the question to the end, but go ahead. We can come on in. The way you come to the shows is you can either just show up and cross your fingers that we have extra seats, but we reserve a large portion of the seats for reservations. So, and we open those reservations about a week before the show. Now, our next show is scheduled for Wednesday, April 19th. At 7 p.m. And the sad news is the show is already sold out. these shows are incredibly popular. The good news is just before I talked to you, I got off the phone with our presenter, and because it's sold out and I was going to be doing this interview with you, I got permission to have a second show, and I'm going to open the reservations for that second show immediately after this piece is aired. So if you're hearing this and you want to come see our show, go to tinyurl.com/shows@the Hammond. That's tinyurl.com/shows@the Hammond. When you go to that link, it'll open up an Eventbrite reservation page for the show. And you select the show. I think you can reserve up to 6 or 7 tickets, and you make your reservation and you come. And that's as simple as that. We're located in the Science Building on Henry Ford's campus. That's J Building, if you see the letter on the side of the building. And you won't miss the planetarium. It's the big round brick wall in the center of the building.
Well, that's exciting news. You heard it here first on WHFR. Breaking news. We love that. When is the second show?
We're going to do it at 8:30.
8:30 p.m. Same night. So also on Wednesday the 19th.
So you could try just showing up at 7 o'clock, and we have, like I said, a few seats that are. Well, there's my bird clock telling me. We have a few seats available just for walk-ups, but. Those are a little bit competitive. If you want to reserve your tickets to the 8:30 show, just go to tinyurl.com/shows@the Hammond, and you can join us. Join us for a night of astronomy.
Sounds tremendous. Tell us a little bit about the current show. I have a little bit of information on it from a different perspective, to be honest. But, you know, don't want to sound self-serving, so we'll let you talk a little bit about the show.
Yeah, Susan narrates our spring show. Along with Dale Van Thorpe, and the show is on constellations you can see in the springtime, it's with science of astronomy peppered in there very gently, and the latter part of the show is dedicated to the planets that you can see with your naked eye right now, and those two planets are Venus and Mars.
Excellent. We have been enjoying some clear nights this week and enjoying being able to see multiple planets just in the darker areas of the night sky, which is always terribly exciting. And then a week or so ago, we were able to see potentially 3 or 4 planets, depending on where you were.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, we had a nice window where we could see 5 of them if you had a telescope.
Wow, that's amazing. Is that getting, this is subjective perhaps, but I don't remember this many opportunities to see this many planets as a child or, you know, growing up. It's quite exciting.
If you look at the orbits of the planets and you realize that the closer to the sun they are, the faster they move around the sun, it creates kind of a spinning clock with multiple hands. And those hands, every once in a while, will get in the same vicinity. And that, at that point, when you look that direction in the sky, you can see a lot of those planets. Because the clock has those hands spinning at different rates, and some are closer to the sun and some are further away, many times they'll be spread out. But every once in a while, you get several of them lining up. They're never perfectly in a line. The picture of when all the planets align and you kind of picture a row of planets right in a line, that never happens. I don't think ever. But you'll get a collection of them all in the same direction. And when that happens, it's astronomer's delight because you can show people all the planets. And we did that a few weeks ago at a star party on campus. We got to see 5 stars in a row.
Yeah.
In a row time-wise, not directly in a row. But,
got it.
Yeah. It doesn't happen all that often. And you know what's really cool is we just put up a picture out front of the planetarium that has all the planets in the precise locations that they were when the college was founded.
Mm.
And it's a unique astronomical timestamp on the moment the college was founded, because those planets will never, ever be in those exact positions again, ever.
That's very cool.
Very cool.
Kind of in a sort of romantic in one of those sort of.
I think so. Yeah.
Kind of things. I love it. That's fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that. Another reason to come out to the Hammond Planetarium in the J building on the campus of HFC. I know that, Jesse, clearly your passion is astronomy, and we have had some other wonderful professors that have come before you and that are still working. And, you know, Steve Morrell, just a, you know, great, wonderful guy and great leader of the planetarium for so many years. So we know that this is popular. We know that classes run and students love them. And so I just want to do a quick sort of a plug for our non-traditional students that might be interested in potentially taking a class about astronomy. So I'm guessing that's very open and accessible to any member of our community that might like to learn more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have on campus and remote learning astronomy courses available to all. Astronomy 131 is the course number if you're looking.
Perfect.
And I teach one on campus, and we have many of them online as well.
Great. Because we like to share what we know at Henry Ford College, one of the most exciting parts, as I was dabbling through the Hammond Planetarium website, was stumbling across these educational resources that I didn't know existed. And so that was really exciting to see. So tell us a little bit about that. We might have some grade school teachers listening, or some, again, people that just want to look at some stuff or check out some links, etc. What's this all about?
It's just a resource for anyone that wants to dig deeper, particularly if they've been to our shows and they want to learn a little bit more. Those resources are for people to either educate themselves or by extension educate their students if they're teaching any courses related to astronomy.
Great. And easy enough to find right on that Hammond Planetarium website. So that's fantastic. It seems like since you have stepped into the role of Planetarium Director, you have a good, well-rounded grasp of sort of the role that the Planetarium should have in our campus community as well as our community at large. Resources, keeping the shows going, working your magic and adding another show for Wednesday the 19th, which is tremendous. What's maybe on your long-term mind? You thinking of anything? Is there an
absolutely
idea to branch out?
As I've just got a year or so under my belt as being the planetarium director, I am starting to look at, okay, so what's the big picture of things that I want to execute? I really want to make the planetarium a home for astronomy in the Dearborn community. And my first order of business, I believe, is to cater a show specifically to children. Our shows that we have right now are accessible to children, but they're more geared towards people in their teens, 20s, and up. Like I said, my 8-year-olds have been to the shows and they enjoyed it, but it doesn't have the... It's not poppy enough for the little kids. Mm-hmm. So I think my first step is the director in terms of programming shows is to design a show specifically for children. We get a lot of kids groups coming. We have elementary schools that come visit the planetarium on Fridays. We have, like I said, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts troops that are coming in for shows. And I'd really like to see a show that approaches them at their level. So that's step one.
Nice. Well, yeah. that's going to be an undertaking in and of itself. So
huge,
we'll let,
yes,
we'll let you
yes. I'm just starting to understand how to edit shows, and like I said, very intimately familiar with your voice because I've heard it a million times as I'm editing these shows. But certainly, when I get to the point where we're ready to do some voiceovers, you'll get a call from me.
Oh, I hope so. And it's funny, the minute you said that about children's shows, I'm thinking, oh, totally different style, totally different vocal style for that. Still, you know, you still got to have
just a little over top. That's all.
But, yeah, just a little more woo kind of a thing. But yeah, well, I love it. I absolutely have loved my relationship with the planetarium over the many, many years, and having the pleasure of working with former colleague and just dear lifelong friend of Dale Van Dorp, who most in the Dearborn community know his name, his reputation, yeah. His very far-reaching experiences in this community. So that really was just one of the honors of my professional career. So you know I'm there when you call anytime. We are very excited to have taken this peek into this really amazing resource on our campus, Jesse, and we're so excited that you have stepped in a major way here and are really just, you know, continuing to keep the tradition of what we've known, but also to expand and provide additional opportunities and resources. So we thank you for that. And anything that, you know, you want to share before we wrap up? I was going to ask you, well, you know, this is me. I was going to say, you know me. Well, you're getting to know me. So oftentimes they'll say, I was going to ask you that. And then I circle back. I'm like, you know, I'm just going to do it. So have you had a celestial experience?
I thought you were going to say UFO experience.
Yeah, no. That is one that you will never forget. You know, one that was
okay. Okay. This is perfect. I can also plug something that I think absolutely every single person who's listening. I hope you all consider coming to the planetarium sometime. But I hope every single person that hears this makes plans to see the total solar eclipse in 2024, April 8th, 2024. There will be a total solar eclipse visible through a large part of the country. You only have to drive as far south as Ohio to see it. You may have like heard, oh, there was a total solar eclipse in Michigan. You haven't seen a total solar eclipse in Michigan. What you have probably seen is partial solar eclipses, and they're related, but to call the two things by the same name, eclipse, is almost a shame, because the total solar eclipse I saw in 2017 was absolutely indescribable. I had given many shows, many talks on the eclipse to encourage people to go see it. And I'd always ask people who had seen eclipses in the show, can you describe what the total solar eclipse was like for you? And they were always speechless about it. And I thought that was cool. And when I saw it, I finally understood why, because I'm getting emotional just talking about it. It's mm-hmm. such a powerful experience to watch the sun disappear and then the sky go dark, and then for the birds to stop chirping and for the insects to come out and start chirping. It's such a weird, wild celestial experience. So April 8th, 2024, do yourself, your friends, and your family a favor and go see the total solar eclipse. That is such a powerful, powerful moment. And there won't be another one for many, many years. So this is a great opportunity. And you only have to drive down to Ohio to see it. So that is the powerful celestial experience. But I would go back to, like, anytime you are in a place that's dark enough, and in Michigan you only have to drive a couple hours to do that. Anytime it's dark enough and you go outside, and provided a full moon's not out, and it typically washes out the sky, but if it's dark enough and the moon's not interfering, just look up and just take it in. It's unfathomable what you're looking at. And then come to the planetarium and learn a little bit about what you're looking at, and it makes the experience that much better.
Sounds like a plan. Jesse Mason, such a pleasure getting to know you today and sharing this wonderful insight with our WHFR listeners. Jesse, as planetarium director, again, we know that your plate is full, and then adding classes on top of that, it's a lot, but we thank you for your commitment to the cause and to science and to astronomy as well. One more time, would you please share the number or the website to reserve tickets for that for that second show, and then I know there will be another one opening up in the next month. And also contact number in case somebody really does want to chat with you directly about any of this stuff.
Sure. Let me take a quick second and look at my phone to make sure I remember my phone number. It's 313. Yeah, no, I don't use it that often. 313-317-6858.
Okay.
You can get a hold of me in my office, or you can just contact me at planetarium@hfcc.edu. That's my email. And the show on April 19th that we are opening up for WHFR listeners is going to be at 8:30. And to reserve your tickets, they're totally free, all ages. You go to tinyurl.com/shows-at-the-Hammond. tinyurl.com/shows-at-the-Hammond. And if you can't make April 19th, come to the one next month, May 17th.
Excellent. But we're hoping that our listeners are going to fill the planetarium.
I'm sure they will.
On the 19th, and we're looking forward to hearing more about projects and ideas that you've got for moving forward. Thank you so much for your time today. It really was a pleasure to chat with you. Continued success, and don't be a stranger. Come by and see us again sometime, okay?
Thanks for having me, Susan.
All right, all the best. Jesse Mason, Planetarium Director of the Hammond Planetarium here on the campus of Henry Ford College, 5101 Evergreen Road in beautiful Dearborn, Michigan. And if you are listening on the web right now at WHFR.FM and you're thinking of making a trip into the Dearborn area, well, this is a really nice reason to come and join us. So we'd love to have you check out all the resources we have available on our campus at Henry Ford College, including the Hammond Planetarium. We've got more to come. Stay with us here on the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and we'll be right back.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dennis Brown II of Plymouth, Michigan. April is Autism Awareness Month. The Centers for Disease Control says that you should have your child screened for autism between 18 and 24 months, or if you or your doctor is concerned. If your child shows developmental delays and learning challenges, seek intervention as soon as possible. For information on this and more, log on to autismspeaks.org.
The Emirates Mars mission celebrates 2 years in orbit around the red planet. This week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Alahmet of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. One of my personal favorite space missions, the United Arab Emirates Hope mission to Mars, has spent 2 years in orbit around our planetary neighbor. It's about to wow all of us as it enters a new phase of exploration, taking a closer look at Mars's moon Deimos. Mohsen Alawadi, director of the Space Missions Department at the UAE Space Agency, joins us to celebrate the mission's exploratory anniversary. We'll close out this episode with Bruce Betts and a peek at the upcoming night sky in What's Up. We'll dive into our regularly scheduled updates from our weekly newsletter, The Downlink, in just a moment. But first, we have a headline that you won't want to miss. On Monday, April 3rd, NASA announced the crew of the highly anticipated Artemis II mission around the moon. Meet the Artemis II crew.
I'm Christina Cook. I'm a mission specialist.
I'm Jeremy Hansen. I'm a mission specialist.
I'm Victor Glover. I'm the pilot.
I'm Reed Wiseman. I'm the commander for the Artemis II mission to the moon.
To the moon.
To the moon.
To the moon.
That clip is brought to you by the amazing people at NASA and the Canadian Space Agency. I'll link to the official crew announcement, including this video, on the website for this episode at planetary.org/radio, because this is a moment we all deserve to celebrate. The Artemis II mission is crucial. It marks the first crewed mission to orbit the moon in over 50 years. It will carry three NASA astronauts and one astronaut from the Canadian Space Agency. It's also near and dear to my heart and so many others, because the Artemis II mission will take the first woman, the first person of color, and the first non-U.S. citizen beyond low Earth orbit. I'm so excited for the crew and for all of us Earthlings that will be cheering them on. Artemis II will test NASA's Space Launch System and the Orion spacecraft to make sure that everything operates as designed. This mission is a stepping stone for future lunar surface missions like Artemis 3 and long-term lunar science. It's bound to inspire the next generation of explorers, the Artemis generation. It's also a fun moment for all of us here at the Planetary Society, for many, many reasons. But one of them is that we've been cheering on the Canadian Space Agency's Jeremy Hansen for ages. In fact, here's what he said at a Planetary Radio Live event in Toronto 8 years ago.
And someday, somebody's going to come into my office or more likely phone me and say, hey, it's go time, and it's your turn to fly in space, and that's pretty incredible.
Congratulations, Jeremy. And also Christina, Victor, and Reed. Our hearts will be with you as you prepare for your mission around the moon. Artemis 2 is currently scheduled to launch no earlier than November 2024. We'll keep you all updated as we learn more. And with that happy solar wind in our sails, let's move on to our most recent downlink headlines. A Chinese lunar sample return mission has found water. Researchers analyzing lunar regolith brought back to Earth in 2020 by the Chang'e 5 spacecraft have found water trapped in glass beads. The beads are thought to have formed from lunar material that was ejected during asteroid impacts, then cooled when it fell back to the surface. There's enough water in these beads to suggest that the top 12 meters, or 40 feet of lunar surface, contains 270 trillion kilograms. That's 600 trillion pounds of water. That could be a huge help for future lunar settlements. Meanwhile, the European Space Agency is considering developing an independent human spaceflight program. ESA, which currently partners with NASA and other space agencies for its astronaut program, is assessing a report from a high-level advisory group that recommends developing independent capabilities, including crewed vehicles, a commercial space station, and a European human landing on the moon within the decade. All I'm saying is, it's a good time to be a space fan. You can learn more about these and other stories in our March 31st edition of The Downlink, our weekly newsletter. Read it or subscribe to have it sent to your inbox for free every Friday at planetary.org/downlink. Today we're celebrating the United Arab Emirates HOPE mission to Mars. The Emmett's Mars mission is the first Arab-led planetary exploration mission and has been orbiting the Red Planet for 2 years. HOPE has been instrumental in studying Mars's atmosphere and has already released 6 batches of data. Now with a new focus on Deimos, one of Mars's 2 moons, the mission aims to provide the international scientific community with previously unseen observations and data. The first Deimos flyby began in late January. And the data gathered so far promises to unveil fascinating new insights into this lesser-known celestial body. Researchers are only just beginning to publish papers on the amazing data gathered by the Emirates Mars mission. HOPE's unique orbit has allowed it to observe and analyze the planet's atmosphere and climate in ways we've never been able to do before. As people begin to delve into the data, the results have already been fascinating. The mission has observed everything from cloud belts to dust storms, and researchers are comparing its findings to computer models to let us know more. This is helping scientists fine-tune our understanding of Mars's weather and climate, but one of the coolest results has got to be what we're learning about Mars's aurorae. On Earth, our planet is protected by a global magnetic field that guides charged particles from the sun toward our planet's magnetic poles. When the charged particles hit our planet's atmosphere, it produces the beautiful lights of the aurorae. Mars doesn't have the global magnetic field that we do, but it does exhibit a phenomenon known as proton aurorae. Usually these kinds of aurorae are formed when charged particles from the sun interact with Mars's atmosphere, creating a uniform glow. But the HOPE mission has found that these aurorae can actually be patchy or localized. This suggests that there are multiple factors at play, like the solar wind plasma reaching Mars's atmosphere, or turbulence causing the glow to appear in different areas. The HOPE mission's discoveries are shedding new light on Mars and its atmosphere, and there's still so much more to learn. To discuss this historic mission and the exciting new focus on Deimos, we're honored to have Mohsen Elawadi on our show today. Mohsen began as the lead systems engineer on the Emirates Mars mission, and 7 years later, He is now the director of the Space Missions Department at the UAE Space Agency. Hi, Mohsen. Marhaban bikum fi Planetary Radio.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
I cannot believe that it's been more than 2 years since HOPE went into orbit around Mars. I feel like it was just yesterday that we were celebrating that spacecraft's arrival at Mars, along with NASA's Perseverance rover and China's Tianwen-1. How does it feel now that it's been 2 years?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, time really does fly by. It honestly feels like it was only yesterday when we were anticipating that we will enter the Martian orbit for the MRS Mars mission. I think with how busy we've been with not only this mission, but everything else as well, it's just been unbelievable on also the achievement that was accomplished by the mission itself. Honestly, hard to digest and believe that really has been 2 years so far.
I've been a huge fan of the HOPE mission since I first learned that the UAE Space Agency was going to attempt an interplanetary mission. My brother, who actually does not work in the space sector, came to me with a YouTube video explaining the mission and what the name represents. So for people who are just now learning about the Emirates Mars mission, why did the UAE choose to name their spacecraft HOPE?
The naming was not chosen randomly. Back in 2015, there was an announcement from the Prime Minister on giving the public an opportunity to choose a name for the mission. Through that campaign, the result was the name HOPE. And it sat well because the mission is not only about achieving the science objectives, the technology or technical objectives, but also to send hope for the region. You know, we come from a region that is not in the most, you know, friendliest neighborhood. The idea was, how can we start changing the mentalities? How can we show that we have a better and a bigger opportunity than what we believe that we have? So the limitation that we put for ourselves, thinking that we are not capable of such thing. So this mission was to send the message of hope, not for the UAE only, but also for the region. And that's why that name really resonated well with all of us, because the message that it takes with it, it's, again, bigger and beyond the technical and the scientific objectives of the mission.
Honestly, I got a little emotional when I first heard about it, because I think, particularly for people living in countries like the United States that have a very robust space sector, it's easy to forget that there are kids around the world that are dreaming of working in space, but don't really have the opportunities because the regions that they live in are still working to build their presence in space. So as someone whose family comes from the Arab world, I want to let you know how much it means to me that the UAE chose to name their mission HOPE, and that a whole new generation of kids have a new dream to aspire to. I think the mission is really living up to its namesake.
Really glad to hear that. And yes, that's the exact purpose of the name. And whoever is from this region really understand why this name is really important, why this mission and what represents means a lot to all of us.
So it's been 2 years since HOPE went into orbit around Mars. What has that time been like for your team since the successful orbital insertion of the spacecraft?
As soon as, you know, we did that successful Mars orbit insertion back in February 9th of 2021, we did not go and conduct science right away. So that was the first time that now the spacecraft is orbiting Mars. It was the time to confirm that whatever we designed is actually working, whatever we put numbers and parameters in are all making sense. That was the first time, again, we're actually observing the Martian atmosphere. So it took us approximately 2 months before we conducted and started the actual science. So May, approximately April, end of April, May timeline of that same year, 2021, was when the science was conducted officially. And since then, the science team, I mean, you know, mostly the spacecraft team, the mission operations team, they were the ones that were heavily involved. And the science team, you know, existed from 2014 as well. I mean, that's how we were working together. All of this team was working together. By the time that we got to Mars, it was approximately 6 years that they were going through these trainings. And now it was the first time they're actually going to work on data on a mission that they worked on and the mission that they put the objectives on for the science aspect. And that's when, you know, the science team now were taking the lead, that this is their time now. We are in the science orbit, trying to understand the data that they're seeing, try to see what they learned in the last 6 years and how can they now implement it on the Emirates Mars mission data.
Part of what allows HOPE to do this science looking at Mars's atmosphere is its unique orbit around the planet. So how does its special position relative to the planet help it study the Martian atmosphere and its climate?
And that is one of the reasons we positioned the mission at this specific orbit. When we kicked off the mission, the requirement was from the government that you need to do something that's unique. So that means you need to bring in data and information that was not available. So you're not going to repeat anything that has been done previously. This needs to contribute to the science community. So knowing that the team goes to the international science community, understand what's been missing so far about the Martian atmosphere. I mean, of course, there's tons of things that each scientist would love to have, but we focus on, okay, what is really missing from all of the other missions that can help us better understand the atmosphere, the reason that we think Mars loves its atmosphere, and how can we try to, you know, put that picture together. Was that we don't have the full coverage of the Martian atmosphere. I mean, all of the missions that we have today prior to the EMM, all of the mission used to provide data on a specific time on Mars. So let's say a spacecraft that was existing previously used to bring data from the Martian atmosphere at 3 p.m. and 3 a.m. every day, but nothing in between. So it was hard to get the full picture or understand the full picture on what's happening, what's going on with the dust, the storms, what is the full picture that is going to help the scientists to better understand the origins and understand some of these information that was not existing previously. Understanding that by needing to do that, it's not that the instruments need to be super smart or, you know, something that out of this world, rather than the orbit that we have, we get to choose that we are in the bigger orbit that, you know, no other missions are in this orbit. And that's the whole reason we got to this big orbit that is, you know, as close as 20,000 kilometers from Mars and as far as 44,000 kilometers from Mars. Each orbit that we take, it takes the spacecraft 55 hours to complete one orbit. So you can imagine at some point Mars is rotating beneath the spacecraft. So the spacecraft is, you know, in the same position for a while, but, you know, Mars is actually going faster than the spacecraft. So we're able to cover it to get the full coverage of the Martian atmosphere.
And already that's led to some interesting discoveries about the Martian atmosphere, particularly when combined with climate models. It's teaching us a lot. So are there any larger patterns that we're kind of seeing in the Martian atmosphere with HOPE right now?
So the data that we still have, some of them are part of what we've been looking forward to do to meet the science objectives of the mission. And some are outside of the scope, like the discrete aurora, for example. That is a phenomena that the team knew that existed. There were, you know, papers about them, but this was the first time that this mission is actually capturing that data and able to be representing it in images. For the main science goals and objectives, the closeout for, you know, getting that full Martian year is completed approximately sometime towards September of this year. Because whenever we receive the science data, the science team takes approximately 3 to 4 months to validate that data. And that is just the part that they make sure that whatever data is being available to the public, it's validated, it's accurate, there's no missing information in it. And only after that is when, you know, the team goes and does the analysis on these data and do their studies and the reporting and, the, you know, publishing papers on them. So, I mean, we are still in that process. I would say, you know, not before the end of this year, we will be able to, you know, provide at least that first results of what we've seen from the full Martian year.
HOPE is about to go on a whole new adventure. It's already begun, and it's changed its orbit to go investigate Deimos. Why has your team chosen to change the orbit of the spacecraft in such a big way in order to check out this moon?
Demos, starting with the mission, you know, we never talked about it. We never publicly announced it. But we always knew that due to the orbit we are in, there is a big opportunity that we can do something with Demos. We never put it in the baseline either, so it was never part of the requirements. It was never part of the design. It was an opportunity that existed. We kept it, you know, there and without putting a lot of attention to it. Other than if we are in the science orbit, we are, you know, doing everything as needed. And if we see this opportunity again, we will do something about it. So we got that question asked a lot during the design of the mission. I mean, because again, if you look at the orbits, you can see how close we are actually to Deimos. And one thing to clarify, it's not a change to the orbit as much as, you know, really minor maneuvers to the positioning of the spacecraft. So the orbit that I talked about, which is in the EMM's orbit, the 20,000 kilometers to approximately 44,000 kilometers, that is still the same. The numbers are really minor that we did changes. That is not impacting the science of the mission. So the science objectives was always the first thing that needs to be done. With the change that we've done to the positioning or the orbit, again, if we call it, but again, with a minor one, allowed us to have a better visibility and positioning as well to capture data from Deimos. So we are hoping sometime soon we will be able to start announcing the first images of Deimos. Again, this was an opportunity that existed from day one, and we took that opportunity, but without impacting the main science objectives of the mission.
That's so exciting. The images of Mars from HOPE have been so beautiful, but we haven't had a lot of images of Deimos over the years. I mean, some, it doesn't get as much love as Phobos does, but I cannot wait to see these pictures, and I'm going to share them with everyone. Are there any other things coming out of the UAE Space Agency that we should keep an eye out for? I mean, you don't have to reveal any secret missions, but I would love to know.
No, I don't think I'm aware of any secret missions yet. But the lunar mission, I know the team from the Mohammed Malash Space Center are considering now the lunar mission 2 and that, what that will look like. But it's in the really early stages and just a concept that the team is working on. From our side, from the space agency, the asteroid belt mission is something we're working towards right now heavily. And recently we also announced a new program called SUB. And SERB, basically, it's a translation directly from Arabic that it means constellation. So it's basically a constellation of three satellites that is focusing on Earth. It's providing synthetic aperture radar images. And that is the first of its kind for the UAE to develop such a payload. And then the other project that the space agency is funding are, you know, some of them are on a smaller scale with universities, training programs, some of them are CubeSats, but, you know, the flagship missions as of today are, you know, the asteroid belt mission is the next Emirates Mars mission, the next interplanetary mission that the UAE is sending.
I'm just so impressed with what the UAE Space Agency has accomplished so far and its aspirations in the future. It's absolutely mind-blowing that the space agency that just got off the ground less than a decade ago is doing all of these amazing things. And I'm so happy that people like you have had an opportunity to shift to space and make it your whole life. I want to wish you and everyone else at the UAE Space Agency luck with all of your future missions. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mohsen.
So really, thank you for having me. Thanks for the opportunity to be able to share the journey and talk a little bit about what we've been doing here in the UAE. And looking forward to more of discussions in the near future.
You can hear the extended version of my interview with Mohsen Alawadi, Director of the Space Missions Department at the UAE Space Agency, in the podcast and online version of this show. You'll also be treated to two bonus segments on what to expect from the upcoming launch of the European Space Agency's JUICE mission to Jupiter's icy moons on April 13th, along with an update on NASA's Veritas mission to Venus at planetary.org/radio, or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. We'll be right back for What's Up after this short break.
Hello, I'm George Takei, and as you know, I'm very proud of my association with Star Trek. Star Trek was a show that looked to the future with optimism, boldly going where no one had gone before. I want you to know about a very special organization called the Planetary Society. They are working to make the future that Star Trek represents a reality. Boldly go to build our future.
There is so much going on in space science and exploration, and we're here to share it with you. Hi, I'm Amber, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society. Catch the latest space exploration news, pretty planetary pictures, and Planetary Society publications on our social media channels. You can find the Planetary Society on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. I hope you'll like and subscribe so you never miss the next exciting update from the world of planetary science.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. And now it's time for What's Up with Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Sarah.
So, what can we hope to see in the night sky this week, Bruce?
You can hope to see Venus over in the west after sunset. Still brightest star-like object up there. Mars is high in the sky, but it's gotten kind of dim and reddish, and it's going to be saying goodbye to the Orion and the other bright stars that hang out with it over the coming weeks. Orion will drop more. Mars will still hang in there for a few more months, and Venus will be with us for a few more months. I mean, they're always with us, but they'll be visible. And then in the pre-dawn sky, yellow Saturn still visible in the east. We got cool stuff on April 10th and 11th. On the 10th and 11th, Venus will be right near the Pleiades star cluster. So the clump of similar brightness stars with the where the cute little baby stars are forming, and that'll make for a nice pairing. And if you got a clear view to the horizon, you should be able to see Mercury looking bright, not compared to Venus, but Mercury will reach its highest point of this particular motion on the 11th as well. And later in the month, I'll tease a hybrid solar eclipse. If you're in various parts of Indonesia or far western Australia or the ocean, if you just hang out in the ocean over there, and a meteor shower, not a bad meteor shower in the Lyrids. So that's coming up later. Let's move on to this week in space history, looking back for a moment, although looking to the present and the past. 2001, Mars Odyssey launches. Still in orbit, and as far as I know, still working, doing good stuff around the red planet 22 years later. It's incredible. Some hardware that did not work as well, but worked well enough, launched in 1970. Apollo 13 launched this week, 1970.
Wow.
We move on to random space.
You know, I think you could have been a dog in another life, and you'd probably be a very adorable one.
Oh, thank you. I'm kind of a dog in this life sometimes. So you've probably wondered, OSIRIS-REx, how does it compare to, I don't know, Tyrannosaurus-REx? Well, if you've wondered this, here's a little bit of an answer. Without fuel, the mass of the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, it would take about 10 of those spacecraft to make the mass of a big T-Rex.
You know, I've never asked that question before, but I really should have, because that's awesome.
If you go with the so-called wet mass, with it totally fueled, which of course it's not now because it's been flying for a while, then you still get 4 to 5 OSIRIS-REx. Yeah, I think we've learned a lesson here.
I think we need a graphic, you know, for scale.
Yeah, don't mess with T-Rex, I think.
Or OSIRIS-REx. It'll, you know, punch an asteroid and take some stuff.
Don't mess with a spacecraft that steals from asteroids, man. Let us go on to the trivia question. So we asked you, what do astronomers call a ring caused by gravitational lensing? I could see a couple possible answers, but how'd we do?
We did really well. People loved this one. Our winner this week is Kevin Nikta from Fork River, New Jersey, USA, who gave us all of the answers. Said, astronomers call the ring created by gravitational lensing an Einstein ring, a.k.a. Einstein-Chwalson ring, or Chwalson ring.
Yeah, baby.
So, Kevin, you're going to be winning a Planetary Society beanie. We'll send that to you.
Cool. We move on to the new question. This is one that you will know the answer to, Sarah.
Hopefully.
No, you will. In the lore of the Destiny video games.
Okay, yeah, I know this one.
On what planet was the city Freehold?
Ooh.
Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
And you have until April 12th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us your answer. And we'll be sending you another Goodnight Oppie Thermal mug. I'm over here just giving out Oppie Thermal mugs, but, you know, I'll just make it rain Oppie Thermal mugs until I don't have any more because they're awesome.
That is awesome. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about hope for the future. Thank you, and good night.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio, but we'll be back next week to share the biggest space party of the year, Yuri's Night. And remember, space friends, whenever you're feeling down, look to the stars, for hope burns bright. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our hope-filled members. Mark Halverda and Ray Paletta are our associate producers. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. And until next week, Ad Astra.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.